Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 1st of August 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. Well, here we are, August. We've got a little bit of blue sky peeping through in Plymouth, but it's pretty chilly overall.
Yep.
There we are.
But
where do we go from that? I don't know. Well, luckily, everything in the country is rosy. And we thought we'd start off with those excellent ministers that we learnt yesterday, that British ministers, of course, while they're in post, immune from prosecution, including criminal acts. So we're delighted to pop this little one up on screen from Consultancy UK. They're pointing out that actually a number of people are concerned about the jobs that ministers are getting after their posts. And it says that the number of former ministers taking up jobs outside Parliament has risen 60% in a year. So it says, I think this is really shocking they should say such a thing, that elected officials are increasingly treating Parliament as a stepping stone to pursue contracts in the private sector, using their insider knowledge to generate business. They wouldn't do that, Mike, would they?
No.
No. And goes on to say that in 2017, a report from the National Audit Office revealed that in 2015, the government spent £1.3 billion on consultants in the NHS. And the NHS there was a particular focus because, of course, as the NHS has been increasingly privatised, so the amount spent on outside consultants has absolutely rocketed. A mere £1.3 billion. And of course, we know that many Tory MPs have got personal interests in the health industry. And we'll just bring the last one in there, that Chancellor George Osborne, as one of his many jobs, took a £650,000 a year advisory post at the investment bank BlackRock. But I'm sure when he's doing that job, Mike, his heart is still in what's best for Britain rather than what's best for BlackRock or his pocket.
Yeah, but I mean, this is fair enough. I mean, if you're Tony Blair, for example, you murder 500,000 people in Iraq, it's only fair that you get the consultancy contracts afterwards, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say so.
I mean, John Major did pretty well working for Kinetic, didn't he go to? Anyway, he was also involved in an Iraq war, if I remember correctly.
Yes, yeah, so just keep it circulating and reward them appropriately.
I can't see any problem with it myself. But anyway, okay, let's move on to banking, because, well, frozen bank accounts could be, indeed, if you live in the European Union at least. European Union states are considering measures which would allow them to stop people being able to withdraw money from their bank accounts to prevent runs on the bank. Brian, this is fantastic stuff. Now, this is according to Reuters. They have seen an EU document which leads them to believe that this is where they're going. Basically, when a bank feels that it's getting into trouble with regard to its own solvency, that it would be entitled to freeze customer accounts for between 5 and 20 days. And that would allow the bank to be, quote, stabilised. That's good, isn't it?
It'd be interesting if you ran another business on that basis, that you start to get into financial trouble and what you're going to do is just sort of close your bank account down and pretend there isn't a problem. That would be fraud.
It would be, yes, but in this case it's fine. Perhaps it wouldn't be a full freeze, because if they aren't totally insolvent, there might be kind of a thaw on that, and perhaps they would allow people to take out a set amount per day. But Reuters is saying that this is now being debated amongst European countries. There is some division about it, but this has come out of problems in Spain with Banco Popular and also the Italian banks. Now, of course, what's unique about this story, perhaps, is that this is being discussed seriously at a government level. We should note the similarity, perhaps, between this proposal and what might, to the average casual observer, to be similar action by the banks themselves in the past, disguised behind so-called IT systems failures, where people were just unable to get access to their money at random times, RBS, Ulster Bank, the RBS group basically being the main proponent of this initially, beginning around about the 2013 time. And then we started to see other banks copying them over the last couple of years.
Yeah, so they spend hundreds of millions. Is that Theresa May actually there at the cash machine herself, Mike?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No. But moving on then, debt. We talked about the Bank of England's recent comments on UK consumer debt levels. Well, Moody's has now come into the mix here, and they're saying that they are lowering their outlook for UK asset-backed securities amid rising household indebtedness. So they're reducing, they're pretty unhappy with the levels of debt that that UK UK borrowers, UK consumers are borrowing. And of course, one of the points they make is that the debt is rising while savings are shrinking. And this is a pretty important point, because what it indicates, of course, is that people are borrowing because they don't have money to cover their monthly expenses. So this is credit card debt. Okay, they're mentioning car loans and so on, but mainly it's credit card debt. I mean, what can we say about this? Let's see what Moody's had to say. This is a quote from Greg Divies, assistant vice president, who said household debt is high and still growing, leaving consumers vulnerable to an economic downturn, while higher inflation, weaker wage growth and levels of indebtedness leaves those in lower income brackets the most exposed. They're saying that this is a pretty unsalvageable situation, and we've got to recognise it. We've got to deal with it.
Very dangerous, Mike. We've also now got people, of course, can't afford a mortgage on their whole property. They're going to take a mortgage on part of the property, and the local authority is going to own the other part of their house. So people are being trapped into these. It is a trap itself, isn't it? People are encouraged to be putting their money into bricks and mortar as if it's safe. But in fact, if you analyse the risk, it's even more dangerous than just having a normal mortgage.
If in that discussion, we cannot avoid equity release as well, so-called lifetime mortgages, which are being pushed extremely hard on British television advertising at the moment. We're seeing a massive boom in people sort of borrowing money on homes that have been where the mortgages have been paid off.
Yeah,
and it is incredible. You watch the advertising on the television, and they say, "Well, take out this equity release scheme and use the money to buy yourself a new kitchen." So basically, the equity release company is saying, "Well, we can take your property after you've died." At least take a significant proportion of your property after you've died. But why don't you borrow the money from us so that you can upgrade that property and we can get more for it at the end? It is a fascinating.
And one of those contracts, Mike, I've actually seen that the company wanted on a loan which had become £70,000, because as time goes on, the amount that you have to repay increases. So there's no repayments made per month, but ultimately you have to pay money plus interest back to the company. But if you try to pay off that loan early on a £70,000 debt figure, the early payment fee was £22,000. And I'm told from people in financial services that this is completely normal at the moment. So elderly people, many of whom need money, are being locked into these systems, which is stripping the value out of their home and, of course, out of inheritance for children and grandchildren.
So the consumer debt issue, a major problem at the moment?
Yeah. Brexit, and what better way to see that Brexit is coming or not is the fact that we've now got the European Union playing around with its own border controls, and several of the newspapers have picked up on the fact that British holiday makers have been forced to queue for hours. It says four here in the Mail article, as the result of EU border checks. And these are checks being carried out on people who've come outside the EU Schengen agreement area. But essentially what this means now is that if you're British, you're regarded as a potential terrorist threat, because they're saying that apparently EU border control computers are so slow that when your passport or name is scanned in, it takes maybe half an hour per person for a report to come back, and hence these enormous queues. So I think this is a contrived situation. The EU is using this in order to try and toughen up on the fact that there's some movement, at least, for Britain to come out of the EU. But of course, the whole thing is possible on this continuing lie of terror threats, and that we should be fearful of terrorism at all stages.
Well, on the Brexit issue then, I wanted to highlight this article from the Financial Times. Brexit triggers a great car parts race for the UK auto industry. And what they're saying is that, I'll just quote the first paragraph here, if you drive one of the 1.7 million cars built in the UK last year, it's likely the power steering on the vehicle was manufactured in Germany, the electronic control units came from Romania, and the shock absorbers travelled all the way from Poland. Indeed, more than half of the 30,000 components in an average British-made car come from somewhere else. Until June 23rd last year, this represented a triumph of modern supply chain logistics. Now, with the UK leaving the EU, it's less a marvel and more of a problem. Brian, it's hardly a triumph of modern supply chain logistics. It's more the devastation of the British manufacturing industry.
Well, exactly. It's a triumph of supply chain because you can actually get a part. They don't want to talk about the fact none of the parts are manufactured in Britain because we haven't got a manufacturing industry left.
Well, that's...
It's outrageous.
Absolutely it. So what the Financial Times is saying here is that this is going to be a disaster because Brexit means that, we're going to end up having to deal under World Trade Organization rules, which would mean tariffs, a 10% tariff on vehicles and an average 4.5% tariff on components. But what the Financial Times doesn't discuss at all here, although others have, is the UK trade, the balance of trade with the European Union. And on the left of this graph, we can see what that situation is. And it's still, even though, despite the devaluation of the pound following Brexit and the fact that exports have gone up somewhat in the last 12 months, we are still in the situation where there is a 71 billion pound deficit on trade with the EU, which means that the EU is more reliant on us than we are on them. So there is no way that they are going to permit this situation to take place with regards to trade, because they're damaging themselves in the process. And we can see that Germany is already going nuts over the most recent sanctions that the US has put on Russia, because this is damaging Germany's trade with Russia. And so Germany going nuts over this, they're not going to be happy if this 71, you know, the
71 billion there.
Well, but I mean, the total value of trade to the EU is just over £300 billion. So they're not going to give that up over a spat. But it's all okay, because Deutsche Bank has confirmed that they are going to stay in London. The City of London is going to be their main base. They've just signed a lease on new office space for their new headquarters. So this is fantastic news, isn't it?
I wonder whether I could ask, has anybody done an analysis on exactly what benefit Deutsche Bank brings to Britain? What is the benefit that Deutsche Bank brings to Britain?
Well, it pays a few British people quite a lot of money who then avoid as much tax as they can. So aside from that, I'm not certain.
Rest of the profits go back to Germany. Of course, we remember that Deutsche Bank, one of the big funders of Common Purpose, so it's worked extremely hard to help subvert the civil service.
And others. So Deutsche Bank, I mean, this is fantastic news. But in the meantime, Sir Nicholas McPherson, a crossbench peer, former head of the Treasury, also speaking to the Financial Times, has said that all too frequently in the last year, the national interest has been subordinated to party interest. And he's complaining about Theresa May's dealing with Brexit and the fact that she's sort of putting the party first and her position as Prime Minister first. Historically, Britain has always stared into the abyss, he said, only to pull back. My hope is that someone will get a grip before it's too late. Well, look, what's at the bottom of this? Of course, Theresa May is putting party interests first because she doesn't really want to leave the European Union. She wants to create as much chaos and diversion as she possibly can.
Yeah, I believe that on YouTube there is a really excellent little Yes Minister clip which is talking about the about Europe and being in Europe and coming out of Europe. I'll see that if I can track it down. But several people have said to me, you need to listen or watch this clip in view of what's happening at Brexit, because the similarities with that very dry humour are so accurate. Well, what's at the bottom? I can confidently say what's at the bottom is a lot of mud. And Britain as a nation here has got very excited that we've been able to spend £100 million dredging out Portsmouth Harbour in order to allow the two new aircraft carriers to actually get in and berth. So we've got another big article with the Telegraph here where they're getting very excited because that dredging has produced bits of a German bomber, 36 anchors, human skull and a few cannon.
Yeah.
And this apparently is major news because as a leading nation in the world, we can get in there and dredge the harbour. And I better bring in Harriet Baldwin because she's used it as another opportunity to ramp up the fear. So she said that upgrading the future home of HMS Queen Elizabeth is another completed step in the carrier's journey to becoming the nation's flagship, ready to operate around the world and help keep us safe in a world of intensifying threats.
I mean, this the whole news agenda around the new aircraft carriers, it's the type of propaganda that would put World War II to shame, isn't it?
It's quite incredible, Mike, because we are to believe that this aircraft carrier is the defence of the nation. This aircraft carrier, travelling at what it's going to be doing, will say roughly 14 knots, is going to be everywhere. It's going to be all round the globe defending us against Russia, China, terrorism. It's quite remarkable.
Yes.
Well, mentioning Russia, I think we better bring President Putin on screen because he's been talking at Russia's Navy Days. And I'm just saying, unlike Theresa May and David Cameron, Putin actually got on the stand and was speaking up for his armed forces. And I think you just look, I've got to say, you look at the style of this man. He looks like a leader. He speaks like a leader. He's delivering things to the Russian nation that we simply don't see anymore in UK. Can you imagine David Cameron speaking off the cuff to the Royal Navy or Theresa May? If they haven't got the propaganda script in front of them, I don't think they're going to be doing it.
Well, we know how Theresa May copes when she doesn't have the script in front of her. But let's remind ourselves about back in June, because, of course, she was travelling to France. To Paris to meet Monsieur Macron, and the UK and France had decided they were going to join forces to tackle online radicalisation and extremism, and this was going to be it was being described as counter-terrorism cooperation between the British and French intelligence agencies, and she and President Macron had agreed that more should be done to tackle the terrorist threat online. And she pointed out that in the UK, she was already working with social media companies to halt the spread of extremist material and poisonous propaganda that's warping young minds. That's how she described it. We are united in our total condemnation of terrorism, despite the fact we're paying for it, and our commitment to stamp out this evil, is what she said. Now, of course, this was about, a year or 18 months after David Cameron had stood up in the United Nations to describe his concerns about online extremism. And of course, in that, he wasn't just talking about Islamic terrorism or Middle Eastern terrorism. He was talking about domestic extremism and peaceful or non-violent extremism, as they're describing it. And so the question is it really terrorism that they're really concerned about? Well, no, it isn't, because as Damien Collins, who was the and still is the chair of the Media Sports Select Committee, Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, going back a few months, he had said the danger is for many people the main source of news is Facebook. And if the news they get on Facebook is mostly fake news, they could be voting based on lies. So that he was talking about saying that in the run up to the recent general election. So, in fact, they're not concerned about extremism so much as the fact that they've lost control of the narrative the mainstream media isn't, nobody's paying attention to it anymore, and this is what they feel they've got to address. So in a vain effort to regain control of that narrative through simple censorship, Amber Rudd is in Silicon Valley today for the inaugural Global Internet Forum on Counterterrorism, whose partners are the likes of Facebook, Alphabet, that's Google, Microsoft, and Twitter. But it's not just the tech industry, because government and non-governmental organizations are coming together, they say, to share information and best practices about how to counter the threat of terrorist content online. And so they want to formalize and structure how companies, these types of companies, work together to curtail the spread of terrorism and violent extremism on their hosted consumer services, building on the work started within the EU Internet Forum and the Shared Industry Hash Database. They are fostering collaboration with smaller tech companies, civil society groups, academics, and governments. So the lot are all coming together at this point to deal with this problem. So they say their mission is to substantially disrupt terrorists' abilities to use the internet to further their causes, while also respecting human rights. This disruption includes addressing the promotion of terrorism, disseminating of propaganda, and the exploitation of real-world terrorist events through online platforms. To achieve this, they say they will join forces around three strategies. The first one is employing and leveraging technology. The second one is sharing knowledge, information, and best practices. And the third one is conducting and funding research. And they're also going to aim to achieve these points in the next several months to secure the participation of five additional companies to the industry hash sharing database for violent extremist, for violent terrorist imagery, two of which have already joined, and that's Snap Inc. and JustPaste.it. They want to reach 50 companies to share best practices, and they want to conduct four knowledge sharing workshops. But at the bottom line here is that they want to shut down certain types of conversations. So what did Amber Rudd have to say? She said, terrorists and extremists have sought to misuse your platforms to spread their hateful messages. This forum is a crucial way to start turning the tide. The responsibility for tackling this threat at every level lies both with government and with industry. We have a shared interest. We want to protect our citizens and keep the free and open internet we all love. The fight is moving from the battlefield to the internet, she said. So what's the price of this, I was wondering, because there must be a price. And perhaps this gives us a clue, because this is the Centre for Public Integrity. And they have posted this article, Saving Face, Facebook Wants Access Without Limits. And basically the article is talking about how Facebook was sued, at least the suit began in 2015, over their use of facial recognition. I mean, I have to say it is strange that there should be any surprise that Facebook is using facial recognition. I think the clue's in the name. It's called Facebook. That's what it is. It's all about faces. That's why they were driving the selfies craze so hard and getting people to post selfies on Facebook and then tag those selfies so that they could start building their facial recognition database. It's also why governments have moved to facial recognition as the form of identity checking of choice. If you look at your passport and so on, that's the biometric of choice. But anyway, they were sued in 2015, and that case is still ongoing. Facebook has, in the meantime, stepped up its lobbying of governments on the state and the national level, because they want to be able to carry on this agenda with impunity. And just to give an impression of where this is going, they are looking at, well, they have already filed patents for technology which allows Facebook to tailor ads based on users' facial expressions. So what that means is that you'll be sitting reading a web page, and your face, your expression will change as you read it, and they want to fire off tailored ads based on that.
I think it's going to mean I get a lot of grumpy ads, Mike, because I'll be there looking at some of the stuff and I'm feeling grumpy, and I'm going to be getting grumpy ads.
Well, that may well be, but is that going to be the price that Facebook asks in return for doing the government a favour by shutting down the alternative narratives that is really the target of all this online extremism rhetoric?
It's quite amazing, isn't it? We go back a couple of years and David Cameron metaphorically was in bed with Google. I can't remember the lady's name, but she was the European president of Google and very close relationship there. So there were those ties, but apparently they didn't see any of this problem coming. Now the problem for international terrorism is to spy on every single person on the planet. And of course, that article we've just covered with the delays as European border controls are checking people. This is a key part of it.
Yeah.
Facial recognition data, blood group, fingerprinting, iris scan. There is a dictatorship closing in extremely quickly. But I did notice that you mentioned that they said they were out to disrupt terrorists and protect human rights. So I thought we might step across to how good human rights are in UK. And thank you very much to our viewer who pointed this Twitter page out to us. It's Alex Cavendish, who is writing about what's really going on in prisons. And he tweeted out yesterday, HM Prison The Mount, inside sources stating too many young, inexperienced officers had been deployed. Prison has been on the brink for weeks. And of course, what was this tweet about? Well, it was about the fact that there's been prison riots in HMP The Mount. They've had to send in a special squad, tornado squad, in order to re-establish control. We see this as part of what appears to be the orchestrated breakdown in our UK prison system. We'll come on to that in just a moment. But Mr. Cavendish, who's quoted in this article, said that he'd warned just days ago that the prison was on the brink of a meltdown. He said the technical term is that the staff have lost control of two wings. What lost control really means is that the prisoners are basically rioting in layman terms. Isn't it interesting? We've just heard about the fact if people use Facebook to get their news, it's all lies and they can't make a decision. But here we've actually got good quality material coming out on the Twitter page. Mm. And that's used as the source of this story.
Yeah.
Because it is so accurate. So somebody's lying somewhere in government, I think. We picked up this. An assessment from the Jails Independent Monitoring Board said that last summer, all the ingredients were in place for the Mount to suffer disorder, such as been experienced in other prisons, staff shortages, readily available drugs and mounting violence. So once again, we've got an organisation warning and a member of the public warning what was going to take place. The government does nothing. And sure enough, the events occur. Well, where do we go from that? Melanie Shaw, of course, has been making her own reports when she can get letters out and reporting from a solitary confinement cell. I'd just like to bring you back to this letter, which I mentioned the other day, where she says she's still in solitary confinement. But of course, inside this letter, she also said something else. She said the officers have or are losing grip. I say this as alarms are going off all day, every day. These are personal alarms officers carry. The segregation unit, the SEG, is full with all 14 rooms taken. What is so embarrassing is it's clear women on main side are being locked in their cells for serious violence. And maybe on staff or inmates. And it makes a mockery for them to remain on main side in the main prison she's talking about. There are women openly building joints in front of officers. So even Melanie Shaw, who spends most 23 and a half hours of her day locked in a cell, is aware that around her in Newhall Prison, we've got a similar powder keg building. But apparently the government is unaware of this.
Yes.
So this was also reported in this independent article. It said that high security prisoners segregated for up to 2 years. And the key subheadline there, which is a little bit small, I've put on the right, the regime offered was not sufficient to prevent psychological deterioration. And they're saying that this is permanent damage to prisoners by being in solitary. Inmates at a high security jail have been segregated from the general prison population for as long as 2 years. And where are we? It should come on here. A watchdog warned the regime at HM Prison Whitemore was not sufficient to prevent psychological deterioration amongst those who've been held in the wings for prolonged periods. And if I can just bring the last one in, the Independent Monitoring Board again reported that in December, 11 men have been held in segregation for between 11 and 25 months. So we can see, Mike, quite clearly that the incarceration of Melanie Shaw in solitary for 1 year now is right in the bracket that they've set out for those men. This is the organisation making the report. And I was fascinated on their website to find that this was a report on Peterborough. So I took a little look inside. And in their executive summary, I didn't have to go far. The main judgments are prisoners treated fairly. It says, overall, the board believes residents are treated fairly at HM Prison Peterborough, noting in particular that healthcare is at least as good as in the community. And I found that a very interesting statement, Mike, because it was during that time period that Melanie Shaw was in Peterborough. And let's just bring up a picture of her leg ulcer, which remained untreated for the whole time that she was in prison. So Melanie Shaw segregated also in HM Prison Peterborough, but also denied medical treatment. That must have been intensely painful. And even when NHS England was brought into the frame, of course, there was just a cover up and a denial that anything was wrong. So I did speak to IMB this morning and pointed out the situation with Melanie Shaw. They've promised that somebody is going to call me back. We'll see whether that happens. But at the moment, I have to say the claim is that all is well with medical services at Peterborough. But the reality is that prisoners have been denied essential medical treatment.
Or one prisoner. So the question is, if
how many more?
But the question is, if IMB find that in general the standard of care was quite good in Peterborough, then does that mean that Melanie was getting some particularly special treatment?
Well, that's a very interesting point of view, Mike. Questions to be answered. We don't know yet. We'll wait to see whether they come back. And if we follow the saga of prisons through, of course, what we come into very quickly is that both Labour and the Conservatives have pushed through privatisation of prisons. Politics.co.uk here obviously talking about the problem. And then we've got a Guardian article, prison privatisation should be a national scandal. Well, it is a scandal, but it simply gets brushed under the carpet each time there's a new facet to that particular scandal.
Something we've been talking about quite a lot over the last 18 months has been privatisation, and particularly, as George Osborne described it, the biggest privatisation for decades, which, of course, is to do with the sell-off of government-held property and so on. And we've mentioned this organisation before, One Public Estate. Now, One Public Estate is a combination of the Cabinet Office and the Local Government Association. And the idea is to merge multiple agencies. They've now, as you can see on screen there, they've run 350 projects across 250 councils, health, social care, fire, ambulance, Ministry of Defence, and so it goes on. They are pushing all these people into shared office space and therefore merging their functions to some degree. So they've now launched a £54 million package to, as they describe it, transform local communities and release land for thousands of new homes. This package comes as part of a new cross-government partnership to make smarter use of government-owned property. And so part of this is a £45 million land release fund, which is launched in partnership with the Cabinet Office and the Local Government Association's One Public Estate programme. And that's going to ensure that local councils release some of their unused or surplus land for housing. And that will help meet the ambition to unlock enough council-owned land for at least 160,000 homes. Well, that may well be the case. Who's going to build those homes? Is it going to be Taylor Wimpey? Are they going to then... are you going to buy a home from them that ends up with a leasehold where they have resold the freehold, the underlying freehold, to somebody else, and you find your ground rent as a result of the lease doubling every year for 20 years? So councils apparently can now bid for land remediation and small-scale infrastructure, which will help bring sites forward for housing, which would not otherwise have been developed. So this is fantastic. But at the heart of this, Brian, is the issue of the fact that they are pushing as hard as they can to bring these agencies, these organizations together, and that this is a complete destruction of the separation of powers and extremely dangerous.
Extremely dangerous. Note again, Mike, that this very serious issue is put across in a cartoon-style video. So I believe this is always done because you're supposed to believe that because it's cartoony, this is something you can relax and have a little bit of a chuckle about.
Yeah.
There's nothing really serious there. So the presentation of this very devious, very deceptive. And of course, the locking together of all these agencies with the loss of the separation of powers, as you've just said, is also coming with the fact that we have the government's own behavioural insights team boasting that it can use applied psychology to simply change the way people think within any or all of those integrated units. So this is the hive, I think, that is being built here very quickly. Immensely dangerous, and many people still unaware of where this really goes. And the other thing I think I should comment on is that we are getting more and more reports of fraud and corruption coming in from across the country, followed up by very aggressive attitude by local authorities and the police when you try and expose it. If you integrate all these authorities, that corruption is going to spread ever faster. Mm. And of course, there's no separation of powers to take the lid off it when you discover it and try and do something about it. Why shouldn't we trust our politicians? Well, we've got to go back to these statements. We've had these up before. This is December 2010. Nicholas Bowles, MP, quoted in The Guardian and elsewhere, saying the Prime Minister and his deputy, Nick Clegg, want their people power revolution to unleash chaotic effects across local communities. Chaotic, therefore, in our vocabulary, is a good thing. This is an immensely dangerous statement, Mike. And he obviously blew the lid on something he shouldn't, because he got censured by the Conservative Party. He wasn't alone, though, because this man also said something along the same lines. This is Cameron's ally and one-time advisor, Danny Kruger. And he was actually forced to resign after he said that the Conservatives plan to introduce a period of creative destruction in the public services. And this is what we're actually seeing. It's been sold in the cartoon, as we've just said, as if it's something being built that's positive. But these two men are telling us very clearly that the aim is destruction of the public services as we know it. And I think we've got to put on the top of that that yesterday the Tory, Tory Labour, Lib Dem ministers, it doesn't matter what they do, including criminal acts, they're immune from prosecution. This is sort of East Germany being drifted in under a modern day veneer of liberalism and common purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to end it there. We'll say to our audience all of the information we're giving to you. We hope that you'll be able to at least take some of it and spread and share across social media. Facebook, of course, will be an obvious place to put it to make sure that nobody picks up on news which isn't true. And if you're wondering what you can do, we'd encourage all of you to do something. Stay with what you're comfortable, but if you can write a letter, send an email, put in a Freedom of Information request, or tackle your local MP, then we say that's what you need to do. Mm. And lastly, we'll say thank you very much to those people who've made donations over the last couple of weeks. We're still encouraging people to sign on for subscriptions. So if you're watching and you're not a subscriber of UK Column, please consider doing so. Because we can only do what we're doing because some people have paid those subscriptions. Thanks very much for joining us. Bye-bye. Okay.